When you think of famous rivers in South Asia, the Ganges is probably the first that comes to mind, but it's the Indus River that has really shaped and sustained the region, although despite its name, the Indus doesn't spend much time in India. It stutters along from its source in Tibet to its delta on the Arabian Sea, and the 1947 British partition of the subcontinent left most of it in Pakistan. British journalist Alice Albinia journeyed the length of the Indus and some of its tributaries as part of her preparation for her book Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, which is now available in a paperback edition, and it's published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings Alice Albinia to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What got you interested in the Indus River?
It was when I was living in Delhi and I was working as a journalist with the Indian press, and there had been a war between India and Pakistan in Kargil, so in a very, very remote part of Kashmir. The Pakistanis crossed the border, the de facto border into India. And so the press in India was full of very kind of the usual stereotypical ideas of this nation across the border, Pakistan. And at the same time that I was reading about this very troubled, demonized nation, the neighbor of India. I was studying Indian history and reading, in particular, the Rig Veda, which is the most ancient and sacred Sanskrit text. And the Rig Veda is more or less about, it's set in the Indus Valley. So the Indus, then called the Sindhu, which is the Sanskrit name, is the mother of rivers.
It was considered a god.
Yes, it's the only river which is both a male and a female god. It's really the motherland of Hinduism is in what is now Pakistan. So this was the central irony of what then became my book.
How does it compare to the Amazon or the Mississippi or the Nile?
Oh, the British, when they conquered, they went out to conquer the Indus. They had the Mississippi and the Hudson in their minds. They thought they were going to get this big river where they could ply trade up and down. They thought they were going to make tons of money from the Indus. And so off they went. They named their army the Army of the Indus, even before they'd conquered the country. And in 1843, they marched across the Indus, up into Afghanistan, back again. And what they discovered was that the Indus was an incredibly capricious river, and that indeed is its name. That's how Sindhis, the people of southern Pakistan, know the Indus. They use this word purali, meaning capricious. It's a river that wanders freely across the landscape. Nothing can hinder it. And the British were almost totally defeated in a kind of similar way that Alexander the Great had been defeated by the Indus. And the only thing which really saved this colonization effort was irrigation. So they suddenly discovered that they could suck water out of the Indus, pour it onto the desert, and they made the Punjab and Upper Sindh into the breadbasket of British India, and finally made some money. But for a long time, it was a total disaster, and it was seen as a very, very wicked act of colonialism, both in India and even at home.
It does go through some of the more troubled parts of the area.
It does.
It's almost as though the river says, you know, just when you're starting to feel safe, hey, I'm going to wander off into a dangerous place.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful, breathtaking landscape. But as you say, yes, the river comes from, there are many tributaries which flow down from Afghanistan. The northern areas, when I was there,
were Kashmir?
Kashmir, it goes, there's, yeah, also tributaries going through Kashmir. And then for me, the most difficult part was Tibet. Very, very forbidding landscape. A different kind of danger from the men with Kalashnikovs.
But most people, when they decide to follow the course of a river, go to the source and then work their way down. You did it the opposite direction.
Yeah, it never even occurred to me to go to the source first. I had this notion that the earliest human odyssey was the greatest one. So the migration out of Africa, all those thousands and thousands of years ago, and these humans who came along the coast of Sin, so in the opposite direction from Alexander the Great and all the conquerors who came before and after him, and then encountered this enormous river and followed it gradually upstream over thousands of years, and then finally reached the source in Tibet. So I thought, that's the way I'm going to go. And it was also like an uncovering. It was an unpicking of history, the layers and layers of history which have congregated all along the banks of this river. So for me, that was the natural way to encounter it.
When you said out of Africa, you mean the earliest humans.
Yes, 70,000 years.
But then African slaves were brought in later, weren't they?
They were. So this was the over hundreds and hundreds of years from the time of the first slave boats leaving Eastern Africa. It was mostly a Muslim-dominated trade at that time. The from the time that Muslims first arrive, really, on the coast of Sindh, which is as early as 711 AD. So Sindh, southern Pakistan, has the earliest contact between Islam and Hinduism. And I found that there were these people, when I arrived in Karachi, I had an idea that there would be, there may be people of African descent. And sure enough, I quickly began uncovering this really interesting story, and it's really a forgotten story in Pakistan. The Shiddis, as they are known, consider themselves to be the original Muslims because the Prophet Muhammad had an Ethiopian slave called Bilal who he freed and made into his muezzin. He had a beautiful voice and he called the prayer for the Prophet. But they are the Shiddis still off. They still work as labourers in Pakistan. Their story really isn't very well known. And for me, it was a journey into what is known in Karachi, in the cities, as the interior of Sindh. It's considered this bandit land, rural Sindh on the coast of Pakistan, to meet a family of a Shiddi activist who'd written a very important book in Sindhi in 1952, which has been almost completely forgotten in Pakistan.
Are the Shiddi immediately recognizable?
Yes, yes.
So they are darker skinned than other people?
Yes, but I'm very...
Are they discriminated against?
They are discriminated against. There's been very little celebration of their culture in Pakistan, of their history, of their stories, and what this man, Musafir, was trying to do in 1952 was to say, look, we are Muslims like you. You must recognize us as brothers. We're all brothers. We're all Muslim brothers together. And it was also a call to Shiddis themselves to say, look, you've got to... try and speak the African languages that you still have a memory of, a living memory of, with your children. You've got to tell your children that leva, which is the dance they brought with them from Africa, probably from Zanzibar, is a wonderful thing. You must play your Mugaman drum. And he says, Musafir says, he says, look, the English have their piano, other cultures, each culture has their own instrument, and we have the Mugaman, and you mustn't see it as something low and wrong and distasteful. The Prophet himself liked to dance to the Mugaman drum. So you've got to celebrate your culture. And it's amazing that even though this was written in 1952, the same concerns still surface today amongst Shiddis living in Pakistan.
My guest is Alice Albinia, A-L-B-I-N-I-A. Her book, Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, is now available in paperback from Norton. It's the winner of the Somerset Maugham Award. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Which came first, the name India or the Indus River?
So the earliest name is the Sindhu, which is the Sanskrit name for the river. And then there's a kind of Chinese whispers of mispronunciation. So the Persians, who in the 6th century BC, the emperor sends a Greek explorer to map the Indus, and they come up with the name. They mispronounce Sindhu and call it Hindu, and then after them, the Greeks come and they drop the H altogether, and so you get all the cognates of the name Sindhu, India, Indies, Hindu.
So Hindu and India are the same,
yes.
And Indus all come out of the same root.
They're all the same, yeah.
You started on the Delta. You began at Karachi, mm-hmm. which used to be the capital
it
of
did.
Pakistan.
For several decades, it was the capital of Pakistan.
And it's a major city because it's on the Delta of the Indus, or because it's also on, what is it, the Arabian Sea?
Yes, it's the Arabian Sea. So it was a fishing village, a Hindu fishing village, and then the British really built up Karachi and made it into a provincial port of some stature after they began exporting grain from the Indus Valley. And then it's chosen as the capital of Pakistan, probably because Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, was born in Karachi and associated himself with Karachi.
Is Karachi is an important city in the way that New Orleans is because it is on the Delta?
Yeah, I mean, it has that kind of meeting of cultures, mingling of peoples. So you, in addition to the Shiddhis, you get people from all over the Indian subcontinent. The traders of Sindh, especially the Hindus, were huge, had a huge reach through Afghanistan, right across India, to the rest of the world. And it's really it's a cosmopolitanism that goes back 5,000 years to the very earliest cities on the banks of the Indus.
So you decide you want to travel the course of the river. Can you just book a trip?
No, you can't. It was pretty tricky to arrange. I had to convince somebody. I spent all my time in the Indus Valley convincing people that I had to go through the Delta, or I had to cross from Afghanistan to Pakistan, or I had to go to the source of the Indus in Tibet. It took a little bit of negotiation, because the problem now for fishermen in the Indus Delta is that because of the dams, which first the British put on the Indus, and then following them, the Pakistanis, there is no water. There is no fresh water, really, in the southern stretch of the Indus. So the delta, this amazing mangrove delta, which is a World Heritage Site, has shrunk. It's now less than a tenth of the size it was, because there is no fresh water keeping this essential salt-sweet balance for the mangroves. And so you can't make the journey that Alexander made, that Alexander Burns, this famous British spy, made, that these legions of travellers and emperors and conquerors have made from the sea right the way upstream anymore.
Well, there's also dams along the way. So dams, you have to get out, go the other side of the dam,
yes,
and then start moving again.
Yeah.
And I assume that if it's moving toward a dam, it's moving very quickly. So are you going against the tide?
Well, the downstream of the southernmost dam, Kotri, downstream of Kotri Barrage, there is no water. The river is completely cut off. And in the book, there's a picture at the beginning of a man driving his bullock cart across what looks like a desert, and actually it's the Indus River. So for a couple of hundred kilometres from the sea upwards, you get seawater coming in, and the fishermen are able to go that far upstream. But when I made this journey, the boat kept on catching on the bottom of the river.
Because there wasn't enough water?
Because there wasn't enough water. So in the end, I had to get out and go round and then carry on up.
I'm assuming that the river had periods based on the season where the water was higher,
exactly,
where it was lower.
Yes.
The dams have changed all of that?
So at the moment, the system with the dams is that the water will be let down during the two sowing seasons of the year and when there's flooding upstream. But of course, that water dries up. And it's really changed the whole ecology of the lower Indus Valley. It was a habitat that the British didn't really understand. It was because the river changes its bank so much, you get shifting villages. They found it very difficult to tax, and therefore they kind of sent all their attention to the upper Indus Valley, and really Pakistan has followed in their wake.
Well, they dammed it so that it would do what the Nile does naturally.
They did. The great...
There was no overflow normally?
Oh, there was overflow. There was very, very fertile regions right along the banks of the Indus, again shifting settlements, but they've sucked out the water in this very, very elaborate canal system to irrigate the desert, to turn the desert into a breadbasket.
You don't only write about the river, and as I mentioned, you begin in Karachi with the story of a Bangi man who appears to you to be popping out of a hole in the street.
Yes, so this is a sewer cleaner, a low caste Hindu or a low-caste Hindu who's converted to a Christian and still does this sewer cleaning work in Pakistan and in India. But it was
he would have converted to being a Christian rather than a Muslim?
To try and escape caste, yeah. Mm. His ancestors converted probably during British times. There was a big conversion drive. And yet the irony is that this caste system inherited from Hinduism is still there in the amongst Muslim societies in South Asia and also amongst Christian ones, as I describe in the book. And so this man is having to actually go into the sewer in his clothes without any protective clothing to unblock the sewer. And it was again one of these strange meetings of history and culture and this river, the water of this river, which has been drawn from the lakes and from the river itself into the city, which is drinking it up at a crazy pace because it's expanding so quickly. And so I follow the story of these people who were actually encouraged to stay in 1947 by Muhammad Ali Jinnah himself, who was very worried, along with all the other officials of Karachi, that when the Hindus fled the land that had become Pakistan in 1947, with them would go these sewer cleaners, and who on earth was going to clean the sewers of Pakistan? Because, of course, Muslims don't want to do this work because it's dirty, and there's a sense of keeping yourself clean in Islam for prayers. Pakistan means land of the pure, so no Muslim would deign to do this work, and therefore the low-caste Bungis were encouraged to stay and not to go to India.
So even though caste system doesn't really apply in Islam, it's part of the cultural heritage.
It's there, yeah.
You fasted during Ramzan. Now,
is Ramzan
like Ramadan?
Yes, it's just a different pronunciation.
It's the Pakistani version?
It's the local version, local way you say that.
You're
Arabic
not a
word.
Muslim, are you?
No.
Did you just do it to try to understand
see what it was like, and I found it very hard. I found that my days morphed into my nights, and I would do a lot of my work when I had food in my body during the night. But I think what you're supposed to do is just carry on completely as normal, and it's supposed to be a period of reflection and also a way of sympathizing with people who don't have enough to eat. But I just walk around in a kind of woozy haze because you're not allowed to drink water. You're not even supposed to swallow your own spit. It's difficult.
Then did you try to follow the local customs wherever you went during this trip?
Within reason. I went to the mosque, and I tended to dress in the local way, just often because it's a practical way of dressing, you know, having a headscarf, covering yourself from the sunshine.
Well, it's obviously that there were some physical challenges you faced along the way. You talk about fainting in Karachi and vomiting in Tibet.
Yes.
And did you know you were going to be putting yourself through that kind of ordeal?
I had no idea. I really had no idea. But I didn't really think about it as I was doing it. It just happened. But I did have some rather reproving looks when I got back home.
Fainting because?
Fainting? Well, in that case, it was because I'd been taken to a hospital very early in the morning. And it was the obstetrician was describing how difficult it was for him to save children. So the very high infant and maternal mortality rate, the potholed road that leads up to the hospital, and he was describing a woman who was in labor for 4 days, and then he had to cut the baby out. And even now it makes me feel faint actually to think about it.
And do you remember the smell that made you throw up in Tibet?
Oh, in Tibet it was there were several things. There was the high altitude, and I was crossing illegally into Tibet, as it happened. The cheap Jeep driver was driving incredibly fast because he wanted to get this job done, over and done with, and therefore we weren't acclimatizing properly. And then later on, maybe the smell you're thinking of is the smell of very strong smell of rubbish outside the house of the person who was supposed to guide me to the source of the Indus, Karma Lama, who was an incredibly crazy man with a fondness for drinking brandy, which was the most terrifying thing when you're walking through the mountains and trusting somebody with your life. Much, much more scary being in the mountains and being at risk of being devoured by the weather than it is crossing the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan and having to negotiate with people with guns. At least you can negotiate with somebody who's holding a gun, but you cannot negotiate with the Tibetan weather.
Alice Albania's book, Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, is now available in paperback from Norton. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alice Albania, whose book, Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, published by Norton, is now available in paperback. I learned something that before I read it in your book, I learned from a cab driver in New York, that Punjab actually means five rivers.
Indeed.
Now, I'm assuming the Indus is the largest of the five.
The Indus is actually, there's the Sutlej, the Ravi, the Bayas. I'm going to get shouted at by New York cab drivers now. The Punjab means the five tributaries. The Indus is the sixth. And then in Sanskrit literature, it's known as the Sapta Sindhu, which means the seven waters. So maybe the Kabali or maybe the mythical Saraswati.
Now, you mentioned that the British dammed the river to actually make the Punjab into a breadbasket, but they also went all the way to Afghanistan, were fought off, And that story reminded me of Paul Wolfowitz's predictions that the American victory in Iraq would lead to people in Baghdad strewing rose petals in the path of the American soldiers. The British had the same kind of fantasy?
Amazing parallels, yes, if only people read their history. So what actually happened to the soldiers who were marching across the Indus in as part of this army called the Army of the Indus, very named by the British even before they'd conquered the Indus. And then they march up through Balochistan. And they've all read this travel book by Alexander Burns, who made a journey up the Indus from the sea, and he went all the way up to the Lahore, so traveling along one of these Indus tributaries, one of the five Punjab rivers, the Ravi. And he wrote this travel book, and everybody read it. It was a huge hit. And if you read the journals of the soldiers who were being led into Afghanistan as part of this great victory parade, they're all saying, "We've been duped. We read this flowery prose of Alexander Burns, and we were expecting exactly the virgins of Kabul to strew our way with rose petals. And he was lying. We hate him. This is a horrible place. The natives seem not to like us. They're firing on us from the mountain passes." And they don't really, the Afghans, when they eventually get to Afghanistan, they depose the king and put somebody else in his place. And there were these comments in the journal saying, you know, we thought this is what they wanted, and they seem a bit angry. And eventually, of course, Alexander Burns himself is murdered, and the original king's people come back, and the British are rudely repulsed. It was in history, this example. No one took any notice.
So the river takes you into Afghanistan through Waziristan, where we read so much about terrorists being given protection.
Yeah. So, in fact, I was following the route of Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni, who was this very, very energetic medieval Afghan conqueror who was a very pious Sunni Muslim in the 11th century AD. And he really discovered political jihad. Until this moment, the Muslims who had come, by and large, the Muslims who had come to India, to this gold-laden land, had come as traders and as explorers and with a sense of compromising with the Hindus, seeing them as people of the book because they had their Vedas. Sultan Mahmud is equally uncompromising with Shias as with Hindus. And when the weather is right, he'll march across the Indus. He'll raid temples of Hindu kings, much as other kings were doing to each other. So it wasn't very shocking in India, but he really discovered something for Afghans, for Muslims to the west of the Indus, which was this land was there ready to be plundered. He makes this town Ghazni, and I wanted to follow one of his routes, and fortunately or unfortunately, nicely for me, it meant going through Waziristan. Of course, it was a completely illegal border crossing, and I arrived in my book.
But you're also a woman going through this dangerous area. Yeah. Did you wear a burqa?
Yeah, I did, which was great. It was like diplomatic immunity. It's a culture where women are so sequestered and so defended from the male gaze that once you put on a burqa, a man almost won't look at you. And if you're sitting in the back of the car will be waved through the checkpoint. Rather, I was trying to be truthful about my journey, so I actually took off my burqa, strangely presented my passport to the Pakistani soldiers and said, "Please, can I have a passport stamp?" And of course they said, "There is no passport stamp." And they went and consulted with their colonel in Miramshah, who said, "Send this foreigner back to Kabul." So I had to go across the border the proper way. And the Pakistani soldiers were so worried about sending me to Afghanistan, which they considered this dangerous place, that they said, "Look, put on your burqa. Don't say a word, don't laugh, don't cry, till you get to Banu." And then off they sent me off. And so I put my burqa on and watched the world through these four white bars. And it was it's a beautiful sandy landscape full of forts and jihadi flags, graveyards. And I didn't see a single woman, old women, young women, just men with roses behind their ears and their AK-47s beautifully upholstered in pink and blue stickers, and we passed through Waziristan and finally arrived in what they call the settled areas, the non-tribal region in Pakistan. But yes, this is now where all the action is happening, of course.
Well, the women are not allowed out alone in many of those areas. Is the failure of the Indus to live up to the fantasy the reason the British built railroads instead?
It's very the building of the railroads goes in parallel with the boats. And at one point, there was a kind of attempt to make a combined railroad boat river journey, and eventually the railroads won out the new technology.
In 1947, the Indus was cut off from India through partition.
Mm-hmm.
Was that done purposely? Was it only left on the Pakistani side by design?
It was Pakistan had to carve out a new nation for Pakistan, and it just so happened that on the eastern and western flank of British India were these lands inhabited mostly by Muslims, though not entirely. And so, yes, the Pakistan, one of the names for Pakistan could have been Hindustan. It would have been a very good name for that country. And there's an interesting story about Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who is furious when he discovers that India, which he considered to be it's a foreigner's name for Bharat, the ancient Sanskrit name of this country is Bharat. He's furious that Nehru and his cabinet choose to keep what he considers to be the British name, the old British name for this country, instead of choosing the name Bharat. And he thinks that India has appropriated the past of the subcontinent and that Pakistan has been sliced off and thrown out.
We think of this area as being Muslim, but the Indus actually is a river significant to any number of different religions.
It is. And the Indus Valley really has the earliest and longest contact between Hinduism and Islam. And so you find very, very rich sympathies between these two religions, resulting in various forms of Sufism, almost a complete identification in some places between these two religions, which today seem so very far apart.
And then you have the Sikhs.
And you have the Sikhs, exactly, which there you see a direct drawing on aspects of Islam, aspects of Hinduism, coming up with a new form of religion, Sikhism, and then, of course, Buddhism. So one of the early histories of the Indus Valley is that it became the third Buddhist holy land in what is now Swat, again, another place which is a very, very beautiful mountain valley and now, of course, famous for the Taliban.
Now, I'm confused a bit about the Sufi who are from Persia, the modern Iran, mm-hmm. to some degree Turkey as well. How did they wind up in the Indus Valley?
Well, there were various Sufi sects. And over the centuries, Sufi holy men, preachers, missionaries came from Persia, from Arabia, from the Muslim world to preach the word of God in the Indus Valley in India. And but it's a very kind of loose, non-hierarchical form of worship, and with many, many different permutations. And it's something that's also very organic to the Indus Valley. So you see Sufi shrines which have a very close identification with Hindu water cults, for example, in the Indus Valley. Very, very interesting. It's impossible to define and write down exactly what this is from the moment that it began and until now, because it changes so much over the centuries.
You say that Shah Inayat was the world's first socialist.
That's what I was told.
That's what they're claiming?
That's what they're claiming. They wished that the world had listened to them and that he was, of course, beheaded by them, the Mughal emperors, who were worried about his sympathy with the poor.
So you traveled through Waziristan,
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and then Kashmir.
Yes.
Were you looking for trouble?
It has been said.
Was it what you had imagined? I've spoken to a number of people who grew up in Kashmir, like Salman Rushdie, who say that it's the most beautiful place in the world. It's just so sad that it's been the source of so much conflict.
Yes, at the MoMA exhibition, there's a really, really beautiful picture by Cartier-Bresson of some women in burqas standing on a hill above Srinagar, and it looks like a painting, that photograph, and that's how it is when you come up through the hills, through this very arid landscape, and you arrive on the brink of the Kashmir Valley, and there it spreads out before you, absolute fecundity and beauty. And you can, the story that I was following at that point was the links between these ancient 2600 BC cities in the Indus Valley and this Neolithic community in Kashmir on the banks of the Dal Lake, a trading cedar from Kashmir with beads and pottery made in these lower Indus valleys.
Were you aware of the conflict between India and Pakistan when you were in Kashmir?
Very much. I mean, it's a very militarized valley now. And I'd come, of course, the journey I'd just done was to the line of control on the Pakistan side. And, of course, I had to make that journey with the Pakistan army. And it's an army with different objectives, obviously, the Indian and Pakistan army, but kind of shared culture. So you tend to hear the same kind of voices and eat the same kind of food and see the same kind of notices even on both sides of the border.
And they're both trained originally by the British anyway.
Exactly.
I'm sure many people want to know about traveling alone as a woman, but I'm curious about just traveling alone. Did you feel lonely?
No, I made a lot of friends along the way, and I spoke Urdu, which is very similar to Hindi, and I spoke it really all the way through the Indus Valley. I was lucky because it's a language that's spoken in Afghanistan by Pashtun refugees, and even in Tibet I was able to speak Hindi to this crazy Nepali. But as a woman, I was sometimes felt that I wasn't really treated like a woman. I was a bit like a eunuch. I was in between these two worlds, and even in the very, very segregated part, gender-segregated part of the Indus Valley, where the men have guest houses outside their homes, and two male best friends will never meet each other's wives. I would turn up and I would be taken first into the hujra to meet the men, and we'd sit around having a chat. And then after about half an hour, they would suddenly remember that I was a woman and look around each other in horror and send me off to the house, and then I would never meet the men again. So I really did kind of pass between these two worlds, like some non-woman. But it was being alone, I think, it's good because you maybe make more of an effort to meet people. You're not really a threat. And yes, some of the best journeys I did were in this way.
In the 19th century, there were many British explorers who looked for the source of different rivers. Mm-hmm. You wound up at the source of the Indus, the Lion's Mouth.
The Lion's Mouth.
Is it obviously the source of the river?
Well, it's a inexact science, I think, and there are numerous tributaries plunging into the Indus at this point, but this is the place that the Tibetans consider to be the source, and with good reason, because it's the water bubbles up all year round. It's not snow melt; it's coming up from the ground, and it is an amazing place. There's a cliff of pale stone, and there's a mossy bed, and there you see, or hear the Indus, the source of this mighty river, a tiny trickle at that point. But I recorded it, and you can hear it, the mighty Indus on my website.
Now, we have no time left, but was the food good all along the trip?
The food was delicious, especially in Afghanistan, which my people, journalists I met afterwards, found quite surprising. But,
Alice Albina's book, Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, winner of the Somerset Maugham Award, published now in paperback by Norton. She will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at KGB Bar. That's at 85 East 4th Street between the Bowery and 2nd Avenue. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Are you going to go back?
To
the Indus?
Yes, indeed. I am. I go back quite a lot.
After the reading, of course.
After the reading.
Thank you again.
Thank you.